phone that they should consider mobilizing for dispersant use. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And in response to that, Alyeska gave you or the RRT team an application by fax about 8:30 that morning.
Yes.
And when was the permission then following the RRT team meeting for this trial application? That came what time of the day?
Yeah, my notes indicate about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is about the same time the equipment showed up at Alyeska.
Did anyone from Alyeska during those intervening about 6.5 hours from their transmitting the facts and you giving them final permission basically bug you or harass you to get this permission to them more quickly?
No, I don't think so. I think it was pretty much generally agreed that they would have permission to do it as soon as the equipment arrived and was set up and ready to go. I don't think there was any question in anybody's mind that we were going to try to use dispersants on Friday.
You think there was no question?
Yeah, there was no question in anyone's mind we were going to use dispersants.
In anyone's mind?
Yes.
At the time you gave this permission for a dispersant application, about 3 o'clock more or less, was Alyeska capable of effectively applying large volumes of dispersants at that time, 3 o'clock Friday?
What do you mean by large volumes?
More than 30 or 40 barrels.
No, not at that time. The only mechanism for deploying it was the helicopter spray bucket that belonged to the Cook Inlet Response Organization. And that holds a 300-gallon capacity of dispersant in the bucket.
During daylight hours in the first 24 hours, was that the total application capability they had, that equipment?
Yes.
Did Exxon, per se, ever request use of dispersants within the first 24 hours directly of you?
I want to say yes, but I'm not. The phone conversation I had about 4:30 in the morning with Mr. Harvey Borgen talked about a lot of things, and one of the items we talked about was dispersants. And I remember mentioning to him that Alyeska had the gears turning for getting the equipment up here, and I know he acknowledged that, and I kind of think that, you know, they were probably in communications with the same people that Alyeska was in communications with. So Exxon, you know, was aware that that the dispersant was being considered to be used. You know.
What was the tone of your conversation about dispersants with Mr. Borgen? And I just am curious as to whether you warned him that it would be difficult to get you to authorize dispersants, or you suggested it encouraged Exxon to use dispersants?
No, I think at that point I was very favorable to trying it.
Did anyone from Alyeska inform you explicitly in this first 24 hours that they were turning over their responsibilities under the contingency plan to Exxon?
I don't recall, although, in my mind was the ARCO drill that we had done last May, the May before, where that scenario was played out. And I think probably if it wasn't expressed vocally, it was at least in my mind that same chain of events may take place in this bill.
Yeah, it was in your mind because you this had happened in the drill you did with ARCO previously.
Yes.
You were asked, I think, by Captain Deppe regarding the DEC burn permit, and asked about whether you knew, as you sit here today, what the restrictions were in that burn permit. Did you know what the restrictions were at the time it was issued?
I'm sure I did, and I just don't have a copy of the permit, the approval, the burn permit from the state with me.
Did you object at the time that these conditions were overly restrictive?
I don't believe so.
You said, as the OSC, you would expect Alyeska's response time to be as rapid as possible. Would their response time have been more rapid in this instance if the response barge had been loaded at the time of the incident?
Yes.
In response to another series of questions, they were directed at you regarding whether or not Mr. Taylor, the watchstander, contacted his supervisor, which I presume meant the OD at this time. Did Mr. Taylor, in fact, grant permission for the Exxon Valdez to leave the traffic separation scheme entirely?
No, he did not. It was never requested.
It was never requested. So in this instance, did Mr. Taylor have any reason to contact the OD?
No.
And finally, if we can look again at Exhibit 13B, this, do you have that, Commander?
I did. I'll hear this.
At page 10, this is one of the two messages dealing with the two-day or a week episode of ice in August of 1984. Mr. Johnson questioned you about page 7. Could you look at this, maybe most particularly the last line before the split in the message? Even with the diversion reported in this memo...
Excuse me, which page are you on?
I'm sorry, it's page 7, circled down in the lower right.
Okay.
And this was a memo that Mr. Johnson referenced that said that ships during this one episode in 84 were diverting from the traffic lanes. Even given this episode of ice, does this particular exhibit suggest that the vessels had any problem avoiding this ice?
No, in fact, it states transiting vessels have been able to avoid the ice during congested periods with relative ease.
Okay. Now let's turn to page 10, please. This is Commander Woodle's memo. And in this memo, this deals with the July through October 1981 series of ice episodes. Would you look at the bottom of page 10, please, and... if you wouldn't mind, read the last sentence in Commander Woodle's paragraph at the bottom, the last sentence on page 10.
The last sentence reads, two oil companies, Exxon and Mobil, limited their tank vessels to daylight transit of Valdez Arm, and one company, Sohio, placed a 6-knot speed limit on their tank vessel transits.
During March of 1989, to the best of your knowledge, did any of the owner companies limit their tank vessels to daylight transit of Valdez Arm?
Not to my knowledge, no.
And to your knowledge, did Exxon or any other of the owner companies place a speed limit on their tanker vessels and because they were afraid of ice?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Thanks, Commander. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commander Waldron.
Commander McCall, I have a few questions. Can a vessel request permission to change traffic lanes to avoid ice when there's no conflicting, when no conflicting vessel traffic exists?
Yes, it can.
Is this considered a major or minor deviation?
I consider that a minor deviation.
May a watchstander authorize such a minor deviation under the VTC manual without first notifying his OOD or commanding officer?
Yes, he can.
I have a few questions concerning the information provided by the VTS. What kind of information, if any, does the VTS provide to a vessel in Prince William Sound?
The main information BTS provides is that information that a vessel would not normally or easily have available to itself, using its own equipment and its own capabilities.
We've heard testimony that the third mate knew his position, had a range and bearing on Busby Island, and saw the Bligh Reef buoy ahead. Are you aware of that testimony?
Yes, I am.
Based on that information, could the VTS watchstander have provided any information to the Exxon Valdez that he did not already have available to her and her crew?
No.
Under the VTC manual, is a watchstander supposed to provide a vessel with recommended courses or recommendations on how to maneuver?
Definitely not.
Is there anything the VTS could have done that would have prevented the grounding?
Is there anything the VTS could have done that could have prevented the grounding? No.
Thank you.
In my opinion, yes.
It gets a little analytical here, I think. Mr. Colucciello.
Commander McCall, I'm still somewhat confused about the answers wherein you state that the VTC basically only provides information to ships that they would not normally have of themselves. Then I see examples where it seems like this is not quite a characterization. Because you stated in an answer to one question that the ships do not have permission to leave the TSS. I presume that word leave meant the same as exit TSS, which meant to me that if the ship does exit the boundary of TSS, that the watchstander is to tell them to get back in. Is that correct?
No, there's different scenarios and different operating conditions. Tankers are permitted to leave enter and leave the separation scheme if they have if they're going somewhere.
Yes, I understand that. Okay. But I use the words exit the TSS boundary. I meant the outside boundaries. In the Narrows, the extreme boundary on the left and extreme boundary on the right, that I understood you to say that the ships do not have an automatic right to cross those boundaries and get out of the TSS. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, then you also said that even if the watchstander had seen the Exxon Valdez cross the eastern boundary of the TSS, that there would have been no difference because the Exxon Valdez already knew where they were. I have difficulty reconciling these two views.
Well, you have to look at the events leading up to that instant in time when he would have crossed that outer limit. You know, the ship had indicated to us that they would be going across the separation scheme and maybe end up in the northbound lane for a specific purpose. He was avoiding ice.
Right.
So the watchstander already knew that he would be making maneuvers in there for ice.
But the watchstander did not know that he was going to cross the eastern boundary of the TSS, and Exxon Valdez did cross that boundary.
That's correct.
And you said that, well, if they had the VTC watch standard had seen this, it wouldn't have made any difference because the Exxon Valdez knew where they were.
He would have contacted the Exxon Valdez, and they would have basically, in my opinion, they would have told him where he was. That they would have told the watch standard that yes, they knew they were there and they were coming back in. So the ship was already maneuvering in a situation where the watchstander was aware that there were maneuverings going on. In that maneuver, he for what purpose, exited the lane. It would have been at that specific instance. Remember, these are just general guidelines to give them,
I guess I'm still not with you. Okay. If he had crossed that eastern boundary, mm-hmm. You had indicated earlier that the vessel would not have been given permission to cross that eastern boundary, had no right or authority to cross that eastern boundary.
The watchstander routinely would not have given him that authority. His supervisor.
You're right. Okay, I'm talking about right. The watchstander. Right. So let me go through it again. You said that the watchstander the ship did not have authority to cross that eastern boundary, and the watchstander would not have given him permission to do so. But you also said that had the watchstander seen him crossing that boundary and had communicated with him, which he did not because he didn't see him, but had he communicated with him, it wouldn't have done any good because this vessel already knew where it was. And I find these two answers contradictory.
He knew where he was, and he was coming back in. And he was attempting to come back into the system. Well, How would the watchstander have known this?
I mean, it's all right to cross that eastern boundary if you know he's going to come back in?
No, he already crossed the boundary.
Right.
The act was already done.
Okay, he crossed the boundary, and what is the watchstander to do now that he knows that ship has crossed a boundary he is not allowed to cross?
And then he would have, at some point in time, after he alerted the ship and the ship knew, he would have more than likely told the watchstander, told the vessel that, you should return to the lane, which the vessel was attempting to do.
Well, okay, I think I get a somewhat of a different answer now. You're saying that if the ship crosses a boundary he's forbidden to cross, and the watchstander recognizes this, even if the watchstander believes that the ship is going to come back across and re-enter and get on the legitimate side of the boundary, that then the watchstander should call him up anyway and advise him of this. Is that what your answer is now?
I don't know. You get me confused.
We've confused each other, I guess. I don't know whether it's worth trying to straighten this out. Let me try it again. I believe you said that Exxon Valdez had no right to cross that eastern boundary of the TSS.
You're adding more emphatical words
every
time.
Every
time you
state it for me.
Routinely, the vessel would, from the watchstander standpoint, not be generally permitted to divert the whole system.
Yes, sir. A little on this. Take us through a scenario. Maybe this will help. Step by step, where the Exxon Valdez crosses over from the outbound lane through the separation lane into the inbound lane and then crosses on the eastern side. So now the vessel is crossing the TSS and is now going outside the traffic separation scheme. That's the initial activity. Can you tell us what the watchstander is required to do, what he would do? Just develop that scenario. Whether or not the watchstander knows what's going to happen to the vessel later on.
The vessel would call up, indicate where we're going to be crossing from the downbound lane through the separation scheme and probably into the northbound lane. Watchstander acknowledges the fact. Watches the ship make that maneuver. Now, for some unknown reason, the vessel, as it appears on our radar scope with the overlay, which is a general guideline overlay, there is no dotted line on the water or there is no dotted line on the radar, would see the vessel apparently crossing outside the separation zone completely now. Right? We're leaving the inbound lane, we're going outside towards Busby Island. The watchstander would note that and call the vessel and say, my radar shows you exiting the inbound lane out of the separation zone. or words to that effect. And then the Exxon Valdez would have indicated, well, yeah, something to the effect of, yes, it's taken us more to get around the ice than we thought. I know, we're really going off into speculation.
Since I interrupted you already, let me just do it one more time. Okay, now let's assume that the VTS does not have the overlay. The scope does not have the overlay on it. Go through that same scenario.
Well, you'd say basically the same thing. He would, you know.
From how does the watchstander know when the vessel has crossed outside the TSS?
From experience of looking at the scope, and having a, you know, being able to have a good feeling as to where the vessel is, whether he's in or out. Even with the overlay is not 100% accurate. It's a guide.
You know? I understand, but it's a guide that's more so than nothing on the screen, right?
Depending on your experience in looking at it, yes.
Sorry, but
mm-hmm. Well, I also have a difficulty understanding when you're saying that the VTS performance or function is to notify the vessel of things they don't already know, and essentially that, and leave it up to the vessels to determine what they're going to do about it on two counts. One, I don't think that process is used in the Narrows. I think you follow an entirely different procedure in the Narrows. You call them up and tell them when they're off the optimum track, and they already know that. I mean, if they know all the other information, they know when they're in the narrow. I mean, when they're in the arm, they certainly know that in the Narrows. But you do call them up then. Even in this case, where you say, well, they cross the eastern limit of the TSS, and we call them up and tell them, well, my radar shows me that you are on the eastern side of the TSS. Presumably, they already know that, and you said that he already knew that. But you do call him up. So I don't really see where you say, well, this is the practice, this is our function, this is what we do, but I see contradictions that... There, you do more of it in one place than you do another. There must be a reason. And I suspect that the reason is because you recognize there are different risks in different areas, and therefore you modify your procedures to suit. Now, would that be an assumption that is valid, or is there some other explanation? Because I see contradictions in what you say you do in one overall, but it seems to me that you vary throughout.
I think your explanation is pretty good about the risks and the magnitude or the lessity of Valdez Narrows is and has always been the major concern point for VTS Valdez. And the information we provide vessels to avoid them, you know, meeting or getting an extremis in Valdez Narrows is the main thrust of the VTS and Valdez.
Earlier you indicated that they gave up the plotting because essentially what you were doing was producing a historical record, and there wasn't, I guess, a lot of value in this. But wouldn't you agree that just requiring the watchstander to plot forced and ensured a monitoring that was pretty much consistent and continuous, and then after the plotting requirement was removed, that there was not the same guarantee that the watch standard would be watching the scope?
Now, when you say plotting, do you mean plotting on a Charlotte?
Yes.
The physical plotting on the Charlotte, which was done away with in, I think, 1984, late 84 when we got the new radars, was distraction every to the watchstander. He had to get up from watching the scope and go to the chart table and plot those positions. So he was drawn away from the observing the radar more often than he is now.
But the forcing of the charting did force at least every 6 minutes that the watch center had to look at the scope. Was there any other discipline in effect that would guarantee after the charting that the watch standard would go look at it at least every 6 minutes? Because my understanding is that the watch standard has pretty much freedom to move around and do other little things. It doesn't say he has to watch the scope all the time.
No, he doesn't have to watch the scope all the time once it leaves the narrows. That's why the six-minute interval and why the acquisition is on it to make it easier for him to spot it.
But there wasn't anything you could utilize to monitor or guarantee that he would be utilizing the radar looking at it every 6 minutes after they stopped the charting. Is that essentially correct?
You mean a documented record to make sure that he was doing it?
Right.
No.
Okay.
But again, once the vessel departed the narrows and was in expanding waters, the perceived danger decreased also,
Okay. Especially
with no other traffic in the area.
I also find somewhat confusing the relationships with the RRT. I notice you said that RRT is basically an advisory group, but then I keep hearing, well, we got permission from the RRT to do this, and we got permission from the RRT to do that. I have difficulty understanding how they're treated one and the other at the same time.
Well, I think maybe a little bit of the confusion is using the generic term RRT. Specific members of the RRT with respect to dispersants are required, as per the National Contingency Plan, to approve the use of dispersants. So it's members of the RRT approve certain items. The RRT as a whole is an advisory body.
Mm-hmm. And this telephone call conference that you had with the RRT, I know you indicated it was around, I think, 11:30 or so, but how long does did that telephone call last?
I don't recall.
I don't care about 1 minute or two. I mean, was it an hour telephone call or is it half an hour? How much time is used up in getting an RRT teleconference call arranged, and how much time is spent? Is this significant with respect to the kind of emergency we're dealing with?
Well, the first question, I think the RRT meetings average about an hour in actual time. Interfacing with the emergency, well, they're all involved in responding to the emergency, and it's a coordination factor. And the RRT is giving input to the OSC that he may not be thinking about at the time, but something that concerning Fish and Wildlife people or Department of Interior concerning resources or areas that are under concern. So it's they're feeding input to the OSC, critical input that he has to, evaluate along with the other response mechanisms.
Okay. Now, there was some talk about whether or not you should have, you or the Coast Guard should have taken over the efforts within the 24 hours. I'm puzzled as to how this was done. Even before this issue was brought up and you were communicating and getting information about the activities, were you actually in contact with the man, supervisor, who was on the barge, or is that how you got your information as to what was going on?
No. Phone calls to the terminal, and the oil terminal, Alyeska, had their emergency response center operating, and updated information from whoever was the whichever individual answered the phone at the time.
Okay, I see. All right. Now, when someone asked why you didn't take it over, your reply was, well, all the equipment that was needed or was available was there already, and you didn't have any more equipment to offer, I guess, so there was no need for you to do this. But I'm wondering, doesn't, quote, taking over mean more than bringing in more equipment and things like that, doesn't it mean that you would actually then begin directing operations? You have to tell me. I don't know what taking over means.
Well, if the OSC officially made it a federal spill, took over the spill, yes, we would be giving more specific direction and then purchasing and ordering equipment and hiring contractors and that type of thing.
But could you be giving direct orders to the barge to where to go and what to do and ordering all the civilians involved? Would they take orders from you and do what you said?
The people that were under the contract or hire of the OSC, yes.
Well, I thought in this case it would be the Alyeska people.
It would be. We would basically turn around and hire them because that was the only that would be the only response agency or response mechanism in town at the time.
And they have to agree to be hired out by you, I guess. Is that it? They have to agree to be hired out by you, and then you can give them orders and do this and do that and this other thing?
If we had to get into a if basically I took over the spill, we'd have to basically tell. Alyeska to do the same thing they're already doing. Just now you're being paid to do it by the federal government.
Well, presumably,
assuming they wanted to.
Presumably your orders might be different from their orders, I would guess, perhaps. That's the only reason I can see for taking over.
Possibly.
But has this been worked out ahead of time? I mean, can you just tell them, you're now working for me, I'll pay you, you do what I say, and they have to do this?
Well, it's a lot more complex than that. It takes time.
I would think so. Don't quite understand what taking over suddenly does. I mean, how it suddenly enhances the situation.
Well, it wouldn't have. That's the bottom line. It wouldn't have in this situation because there was nothing. Actually, there probably would have been a substantial delay in getting the federal mechanism up to speed to take over the
But
the
as
response.
Part of the drills and the understanding of working out these contingency plans, is the, quote, taking over part of that scenario?
No.
If you had never been through a takeover phase, quote, the takeover during your drills and to show how it would work or how it might not work.
It's an interesting exercise. No, we haven't. I'm not sure what would be gained from that either.
Well, I just don't know what's going to happen when the day comes that you say, quote, I take over now. Does everybody salute you and say, aye, aye, sir, and tell us what to do? I'm not sure what happens.
In the case of the operation around here, I can think of other places where we have taken over spills in the past, but specifically for the Valdez area for this spill, I can't see how I would, at least in the early stages, envision taking over it, especially with Alyeska having the responsibility to respond. There's nothing that I could have done, no other resources available to me at the time to put into the initial response that they had.
Well,
that they didn't
were
have.
You calling the shots at the time that Alyeska was still working? Were you calling the shots and saying, well, go over here and drop the dispersants, go over here and do some burning? So in effect, were you giving the orders at that time during the first 24 hours in that sense? It sounds like you may have been doing some of this already, and yet presumably Alyeska was in charge.
Yeah, Alyeska as the responsible party's agent, the way the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, Clean Water Act, basically, he who has possession of the oil last is required to clean it up, whoever owns the oil. But in the Alyeska, in the situation with the Trans-Alaska pipeline, Alyeska is the prime responder. They are directing the people. They are responding. I am giving, I think I used it and was quoted in the paper for an earlier spill of kind of like a sidelines coach saying, representing the federal government and trying to see that the spill got responded to as rapidly as possible and the cleanup was initiated as effectively as possible, giving not orders, but giving advice, direction. I think you should. It would be good if you did this. And as long as the system worked that way, then there was no need for the federal government to interject its presence in a mandatory role.
Thank you. No more questions.
Mr. Armantrout?
No questions.
Mr. Danaher?
I have thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two areas, Commander McCall. Returning briefly to, and you need not look at the exhibit.
Possible to take a short break.
Five minutes at most.
Can you last another 5 or 10 minutes, or would you like a break? It's up to you.
No, I'm fine.
Fine. Thank you.
The first area had to do with discussion of the plotting of vessels participating in VTS, in the TSS. You mentioned that the term plotting to the uninformed might be ambiguous or misleading. I suspect most of us here are in that category. And briefly, I'd like to try to clarify it. To some of us here, plotting means the use of radar or visual ranges and bearings and perhaps coordinates, and making a graphic representation on a chart with annotations and so on. That is, I would submit, probably a conventional meaning of the term. Then the manual suggests plotting using the Raytheon data logger, which would almost suggest that the logger logs or makes a permanent record of some numeric data. Would you clarify then how plotting, as you intend, the informed intend to use it, is distinct from the permanent logged record by the Raytheon logger?
Time consuming. The physical plotting on a chart required the radar operator to, you know, leave his station to go to the chart table.
I understand that. Okay. Excuse me. But with respect to the doing of the plotting using the logger, is that another manual entry onto a clipboard line entry?
Okay.
Is it a duplication as a result?
You'd have all the information necessary to draw a chartlet with the information provided by the Raytheon data logger.
Right.
And then that was not plotted, that was just stored on paper.
Or but a permanent record, isn't
permanent
it?
Permanent record, yes. And then that was filed away. And if, in fact, someone needed to create a chartlet later on, you could pull that out of the file and recreate a chart.
So that, however, would you acknowledge that if it were plotted in the conventional sense on the chart, it would give a graphic representation of the progress of the vessel, historic for him, historic in the sense of the last few minutes or hour, and it would give him a better notion of the progress and perhaps a better ability to predict the immediate future movement of the vessel relative to possible hazards.
With the exception of the time lost in actually getting up and drawing the plot.
Okay. Thank you. The second area is you mentioned that with respect to learning about ice conditions in the TSS, that you would either expect or request that the vessels report icing conditions. Is that regularly done as a part of the initial call-up or contact with the vessel?
Yes, yes. It's one of the routine items that the tankers provide us.
Is there any kind of a standing order issued by your organization to the watchstanders that says thou shalt, upon initial call by the vessel, whether inbound or outbound, request that they provide such information?
Yes, there is. There's a standard checklist of questions that they ask, and I believe the ICE information is on there.
I haven't found that.
Okay.
Could you tell us where we might find it in the records?
Okay, I'll have to look then, because I might be wrong then. But it's one of those things where all the participating vessels know we are very interested in ice, and I know we get ice reports, quote unquote, from ships, and I know when they give it to us, they log it in. But I can't recall. I mean, I might be wrong then, I guess. With
do incoming outgoing vessels have any notion as to how recently a vessel may have come through, and hence how current your knowledge might be of existing conditions in the TSS?
Yes, the watchstander, when he passes the information on, he'll say where he got it from and what time the vessel departed or arrived, whatever the case
is. If he has information about ice, again, do your standing orders direct him to advise subsequent vessels of that condition?
Yes, they do. They're advised of it routinely.
And is such guidance or direction similarly in the same location in the documentation that you think it exists?
I would think so. I can't pull it out of my mind from right now where it is. But,
thank you. I have no further questions.
Just a couple, Commander. I think you gave us I won't go through this scenario again that we talked about before, but I will ask you another question about the overlay. I'm still not... Maybe it's me. Okay. I think you said that in the past some watchstanders did, some others did not use the overlay. Yet since the grounding, everybody's using the overlay. Is that true?
Well, there's an overlay on the one scope that can be used.
Did I misquote you?
I have. Well, they have it on the...
I thought you said since the grounding, I'm sorry, the majority of the time the overlay is used. That's what I wrote down in my notes, and if that's wrong, then you can correct that.
No, I think I'm just trying to think whether or not the other scope has the overlay on it. That's what I was trying to distinguish between the two scopes.
Which
I would say, yes, the majority of the time they are using them.
Okay. Those watchstanders that did not use the overlay in the past, what do they think about using it now?
I don't know. I haven't queried them on it.
Well, what good? I mean, what is the Coast Guard's position on why you're using it, since I think you said that it may or may not provide additional information because of the understanding of the individual watchstander?
Well, it adds, you know, for the less, I don't want to say less trained, but the less for watchstanders that haven't been assigned to Valdez as long, it gives them obviously a quick ready reference to know where, you know, where the tankers are, whether they're perhaps out of the lane or not.
So if I went to Valdez this afternoon and sat down at that scope, not being a watchstander, would I be able to at least identify the traffic separation scheme, inbounds, outbounds, and separation lanes?
Definitely, yes.
Okay. In response to a question from, I think, Captain Deppy, but that's not the question. I think you said that you knew that Mr. Taylor did not stop monitoring the vessel. Is that correct? And I think the question was from Captain Deppy, why is it that the vessel was acquired after the grounding? And I think you responded by saying, well, because you have a lot more reflectivity because of the vessel that turned to starboard. Fine. But you also, then I think he also asked you that... would Mr. Taylor have stopped monitoring or looking at the scope or looking at the progress of the Exxon Valdez? And you said, I think, definitely not. Why do you say that?
I mean, he would have continued to monitor the progress of the vessel on out until the image was until the acquisition was lost. Routinely, that's a routine basis. That's the policy.
That's why you say that?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yeah, that's the policy office to monitor them until you lose them on the okay. scope.
One other question. This gets into Zone 1 and Zone 2.
Did you say that from March 1st to sometime in May that Zone 1 becomes Zone 2?
Mm-hmm. For that area.
For that area.
There's two areas in Prince William Sound that have seasonal zone shifts. One's at the other one, well, it's on the chart. The other one's at Montague entrance.
Okay, but you're responsible for making decisions on use of dispersants in Zone 1? So therefore, during that time, do you have no authority?
No, there's a big misconception on what all this Zone 1, 2, and 3 and the authority that the OSC has under Zone 1, 2, and 3. Zone 1 indicates an area where the OSC has pre-approval authority to use dispersants, if appropriate. Doesn't mean I have to use them. Doesn't mean I can use 10 gallons, I can use 100 gallons. So there's discretion granted to the OSC to use them in a Zone 1 because of the immediacy of the situation. It was a Saturday morning or Sunday morning, you couldn't get a hold of anybody from the state, couldn't get a hold of anybody from EPA. The area there in question was considered the OSC could use his discretion and use dispersants in that Zone 1. The other areas, closer to shore, in most cases, were those areas where the state and EPA were more concerned with, well, let's take a look and see what we've got. Let's weigh the average, let's weigh the odds. Is it worse having the oil come through here and hit the beach, or is it worse to use dispersants and maybe injecting oil to some level within the water column, which would affect the marine life in that area? The zone designation from Zone 2, from Zone 1 to Zone 2 in Valdez Arm, March 1st, is based on several things, one being the Solomon Gulch hatchery getting ready to release the salmon fry during the spring and then migrating salmon coming on in also, returning to the hatchery with their eggs for the next cycle. So there's concern about putting water into the oil into the water column in that Zone 2 area from March 1st through October 15th. So that's where the concern came from.
Okay. Thank you, Commander. I appreciate your...
The other thing, too, there's a little misconception on where the Zone 1 and Zone 2 line is.
Can you tell us where that line is, then, without drawing on that exhibit?
No, I won't draw. Again, it's not
Commander Steve.
It's not really hard and fast. Basically, there's no lat lon in the chartlet that's in the book, but it comes down and basically the end of the zone two area here is approximately 2.5 miles southwest of this tip of Bligh Island and about 5 miles down from Cave Point on Glacier Island. So, for intents and purposes, it's almost in a line, right along the wording of the word Prince William, and then diagonally off. So it's down in this area here where the Zone 2 ends, and of course the ship was aground up here. So the oil working its way down for a good period of time remained in a Zone 2 area. So all during the day Friday, or majority of the time Friday, there was that approval needed. And then at some moment in time, the leading edges did cross into the Zone 1. But by that time, this mechanism was already in place anyway.
Thank you, Commander. You have been on the stand for a long time. We appreciate your time and testimony. You are excused. I have 10:15. Let's take a 15-minute break. We'll return at 10:30 with Lieutenant James Rice.
You've been listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings here at the Captain Cook Hotel. We are in a break at the moment, and it looks as if we have a group of demonstrators who are mounting some kind of information or placards on the wall. Can you see?
There are some people who are posting placards up on the wall. Corey's going to be heading over there with a microphone in just a couple of moments. They told us that this would be a non-disruptive action, and there's reporters and cameras are heading over there right now trying to figure out what's going on. We should have a report from Corey in just a few moments. He is heading over there with a microphone.
Tell us who you are, who you're representing, and what you're doing here.
My name is Bob Lohr, and I'm with the Boycott Exxon Alliance, and we're here to say that a non-adversarial fact finding by the NTSB is fine. We don't want to disrupt that in any way, and that's why we're posting these signs during a break rather than during the testimony. At the same time, we want to make the point that 24 hours after the event is not the appropriate place for a cutoff. Regardless of the jurisdiction of this particular board, the oil spill is ongoing as we speak. The lies are continuing. I would like to say that we're glad that Exxon has taken responsibility for the spill. We hope that very soon they will also take responsibility for the cleanup. To date, they failed to do so.
Thank you. That signs are already down, Bruce. The hotel security has pulled them down virtually as soon as the demonstrators put them up.
So we had a brief flurry of action here at the Captain Cook Hotel. This morning you've been listening to testimony from Commander Steve McCall, who is the port commander at Valdez. He's also the head of the Traffic Safety Center, the Vehicle Traffic Control Center, that monitors radar traffic out of in and out of the Valdez Narrows. And much of the questioning that we heard this morning was related to the operation of that radar system, what the people who work there are supposed to do, what are they required to do, and whether or not they were in fact doing it at the time that the Exxon Valdez went aground.
Some interesting questions, too, towards the beginning of the testimony about the whole issue of pilotage. Apparently, formerly, the pilots from Valdez went as far as Hinchinbrook Entrance, and in fact, right through to the very entrance to Prince William Sound. Back in 1979, they lost a pilot boat there because the seas are evidently very rough a great deal of the time. And thereafter, although there were no injuries, pilots were reluctant to board at that place. And that's when the Coast Guard commander at the time made an order as captain of the port that the new pilot station would be at Rocky Point. In other words, at the end of Valdez Arm. So although he made the point that none of this was hard and fast, it was all based on the captain of the port's order, they were waiting at the time for national changes in piloting rules and have been waiting evidently for years and years for these kinds of changes. In the meantime, the pilot, these tankers have been accompanied by pilots for a great deal less distance than was originally intended.
Interestingly enough, on that pilotage issue, two days ago, we also heard testimony from Frank Flynn, Assistant Chief of the Merchant Vessel Personnel Division at the U.S. Coast Guard, who said that there was, in fact, a rule in the works that would make the required area to have pilots even smaller. And that was in the works at the time that the Exxon Valdez grounding, and it started to appear, at least from the line of questioning, that the Coast Guard is going to be holding off on that rule. And but the idea was that they would no longer require masters to have pilot certification, such as Captain Hazelwood had, in order to take this ship as far as Rocky Point, and so that any old master of a domestic vessel could take it, and that you wouldn't need pilot certification. Somewhat of a side issue, but it related to the issue of piloting the boats we heard this morning.
There is a catch-22 here, and that's obviously if the Coast Guard doesn't require you to have a pilot beyond a certain point, then the area beyond that point is a non-pilotage area, and thus you shouldn't have to have an officer on board who's certified as a pilot either. All these things are things that are going into the record and will come out when the NTSB Board of Inquiry makes its report. Some of the hottest, this discussion never got hot, I should say, but the questioning was relentless on some points, and where it was most relentless, I think, were discussions about when dispersant was first mentioned, the use of it was first mentioned, and when it was approved. It's a matter of extreme interest to people from Alyeska and Exxon, who are in dispute both with the state and the Coast Guard about the use of Alyeska. Exxon's chairman, Mr. Rawls, has said, of course, that the state and the Coast Guard were at fault in not allowing Alyeska the immediate use of dispersants.
We heard here that McCall repeat the assertion he's made many times that almost as soon as he got on the radio with the Exxon Valdez and started talking with company officials, that he said you ought to start thinking about dispersants. And he'd made that assertion before. He made it again. And he said that by 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, that Exxon, at that time it was Alyeska, had approval to test dispersants. He went through the assertion again that there was that the test that was held was basically showed that dispersants did not do a lot. And he also asserted that there wasn't really enough dispersant around to do the job had they started right away. And these are all points that Exxon now, Alyeska to some degree, and certainly Exxon is trying to discredit. They're trying to say that they had the ability to get the dispersants they needed to the sound on time, and that the Coast Guard was dragging its feet in terms of approval. Much of this approval relates to what's been called Zone 1 and Zone 2. Now, Zone 1 is the area where they were pre-approved for using dispersants. That is to say that the officer, the on-scene coordinator in charge of the spill, who at this point in time was Commander McCall, had the authority to allow them to use dispersants. And he said, well, the ship was in a Zone 2 area where you're not allowed to use dispersants without, you know, without going through some type of permission process. The spill was heading into a Zone 1 area where there was pre-approval, and so he said, you know, when that hits Zone 1, by the time that oil hits Zone 1, you'll be able to bomb them with dispersants. And so some of the discussion has centered around that. The other thing that we heard was that these zones are somewhat flexible and seasonal, that in fact they're not hard and fast, but that the area where the Zone 2, where you're not, where you need a permission to use the dispersants, you need special permission to use the dispersants, is only in the summer, and between about March and October.
Yeah, roughly consonant with the fishing seasons and the seasons of the salmon hatcheries in the Sound. There were also discussions about the Coast Guard's responsibility, the responsibility of the watchstanders on the radars at the Vessel Tracking Center, and the question, which was repeated by several people, of what more could have been done if the watchstander had called up the Exxon Valdez and advised Third Mate Greg Cousins that he was beyond the eastern boundary of the vessel traffic area. Would that have made any difference? And Commander McCall said repeatedly that he didn't believe it would.
Time and time again, they also said, I mean, that the fact of the situation is that the Exxon Valdez, they had lost the Exxon Valdez from their radar screens, and it later showed up, their ability to pick these up depends on the weather, and the radar operators had testified that by the time the ship turned broadside, it made a great radar return, and so they were able to pick it up. So a certain amount of this discussion was in the hypothetical, but the sense is that people were wondering, well, why do you even bother to monitor these people and tell them that they're outside the established shipping lanes if they know that already, because they're reporting that to you, and you know, what's the point? I mean,
and then there's an additional question too. I mean, budget questions crop up, as they always do in inquiries like this. And the Valdez Tracking Center had a budget change, a loss in some Coast Guard officer personnel, and exchanges of military personnel for civilian traffic controllers. Also changes in the radar that formerly, evidently, they actually physically plotted the positions of these tankers on a chart every 3 minutes as they were going through Valdez Arm, and every 6 minutes as they were out in the Sound. And the acquisition of a new radar that recorded this data freed them up from having to do that. Several people made the point that it may have also have taken their attention away from the location of the tankers.
There was also an issue raised about ICE. ICE has been the reason given by Third Mate Greg Cousins. That was the reason why they diverted from the normal shipping lanes. And there was very hard questioning, saying, well, what is the Coast Guard doing to monitor ICE? How do you do this? And he says, Commander McCall said, well, we get reports from the vessels that are coming in. And he admitted quite quickly that what to one person is a severe outbreak of ice is to another person, bunch of ice cubes, that there is no sort of routine reporting requirement or no routine standards for what constitutes a lot of ice. And so they're very subjective judgments about how much is out there. Also, because they're dependent on the vessels coming in and out of Prince William Sound, that there are long periods where they don't receive any reports about when the ice is in fact in place. And there was questioning as to, you know, do you do overflights? Do you have any type of standards for doing this? And the implication is, what more can you do? And they also brought out some memos that showed that there have been times in the past where the previous captain of the port had expressed concern over ice as a navigational hazard, where at one point 18 tankers had been backed up because of ice, not all at the same time, but over the course of a week or so, and basically was trying to bring Commander McCall around to the point where he had agreed that ice was a navigational hazard and they weren't properly dealing with it.
This has been a marathon session for Commander McCall, one, frankly, that I don't think we quite expected. I certainly didn't. He spent 3 hours on the stand this morning with just relentless, continuous, very detailed questioning, all pointing to the Coast Guard's responsibility in this matter in one way or another, and it must have been a very difficult morning for him.
Another area where he was hammered was the area of training. They're using civilian personnel now, and they said as part of the training and as part of their continued on-the-job training, they're required to take a trip every year on a tugboat and on a tanker, and we heard testimony from the actual radar operators that they hadn't in fact done that, and they were saying, well, if they don't do that, does that mean that they're decertified, that they're not qualified to do this? And Commander McCall, you know, was put in the position of having to say, well, no, it's as important, but, you know, they can still continue their job to do it. But the question was raised, well, if you have these requirements, you know, what's the validity of them? I mean, are you really following these things, or why do you have them in place? And some very strong questioning on that.
Yeah, exactly. He made the point, too, that the civilian watchstanders who tend to live in the area for long periods of time tend to be very familiar with the geography and are less in need of that kind of orientation on the tankers and the tugboats. But his military personnel turn over. The single people turn over every 2 years. Married people turn over every three. And so military personnel definitely need this kind of orientation. The question of whether they get it or whether they get it regularly is still hanging out there.
Another issue that came up has been an ongoing debate, if you will, that's being played out here, and that's the issue of Alyeska's readiness. The representative from